We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchek, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So another crazy week and multiple notable passings this week, but Joff, you wanted to mention Ed Asner's passing?
Yeah, Ed Asner was 91. He... you know, it was in the 80s, certainly, and into the 90s, I think, one of the biggest TV stars in the U.S. and probably internationally, and the 70s with Mary Tyler Moore. But he was also a quietly behind-the-scenes activist. He would show up at different protests. He would give speeches, usually waive the fee. I met him once at a new anti-nuclear encampment in Texas. He's a very nice guy. And from all accounts, that was the kind of impression other people had of him, too. So he will be missed.
All right. So starting with a local and the continuing unfolding story of the missing texts.
Yes, we had a lawsuit that was announced late in the day yesterday. The city employees who blew the whistle on those texts are suing the city, alleging retaliation by the Durkin administration. That allegation should surprise nobody. It hasn't been specified what kind of damages they're asking for yet, but it certainly sounds that this was an extensive cover-up that a lot of people knew about, and the people who made it public are alleging retaliation, which is that's kind of illegal, actually. So,
one of the things that they're saying in their lawsuit is that Michelle Chen, Durkin's attorney, had instructed them to reconstruct text messages for Durkin from other people's text messages and to alter them to make it look as if they came directly off of Durkin's phone, which is a cover-up. And they were the, as Joff said, the whistleblowers, so the folks who initially came forward and told the press that, hey, look, you know, Durkin's texts are missing. She had a setting on her phone that deleted everything in violation of the public records law. So, and they're saying, they're alleging that Michelle Chen was abusive towards them, but also other unspecified city managers. So it would be interesting to see what the details of that lawsuit are and, which city managers they had problems with if Mayor Durkin herself got involved.
I'm betting she did, given how much of a micromanager she reportedly is.
Yeah.
They also claim that they say Ms. Chen instructed Ms. Irwin and Ms. Fiaro not to produce records responsive to a PRA, a public records request, for the Seattle Times because she did not like the content of the responsive records.
Yeah, which is also illegal.
You know, you don't get to choose which ones
you disclose. That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Based on how embarrassing they are for your boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's not okay. Now, Michelle Chen was fired. She's no longer with the city. But
they're all going to be fired as of like January. So,
yeah, she wasn't acting, you know, on her own behalf when she was making those kinds of decisions. So I think someone in Durkin's office, if not Durkin herself, should take responsibility for that.
I think it's likely Durkin herself, given A, how much of a micromanager she is. And this is somebody as a former U.S. attorney. She knows the law.
Mm-hmm.
She was instructing her underlings to violate the law. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem.
So, moving on to this week's election-related news.
Yeah, last week we talked about King County Superior Court Judge Christine Schaffer ruling that Charter Amendment 29 was unconstitutional because it attempts to use the initiative process to overturn the authority of the mayor and city council as set forth under state law. She also said that Charter Amendment 29 would interfere with the city's decision to move its homelessness services to the new King County Regional Homelessness Authority. that's an administrative decision. They can't be overturned by a local initiative. So Charter Amendment 29 exceeded what the initiative process can do. Now, remember, Schaffer said that the decision was not even close, right? And that there are many prior state Supreme Court decisions on this topic that would obviously invalidate Charter Amendment 29. Tim Burgess, who's been one of the leading spokesmen for Charter Amendment 29, he seems to be running the campaign for Compassion Seattle, said that Compassion Seattle would not appeal. However, this week they did file an emergency appeal with the State Court of Appeals, requesting that they issue a stay on Judge Schaffer's ruling and allow Charter Amendment 29 to go to the November ballot. Of course, the Court of Appeals on Friday refused their request. So Charter Amendment 29 still will not appear on the ballot in November, and it won't appear on any future ballots either because it is obviously unconstitutional. Compassion Seattle has spent more than $1 million, probably, and that's probably not counting the mounting attorney's fees for these hopeless court filings that they keep doing. And they obviously have the Seattle Times on their side too, which has still not adequately explained to their readership why Judge Schaffer struck down Charter Amendment 29. They've run at least a couple of articles on this topic, and in each article they kind of vaguely reference it but don't explain the real reasons. They just say, oh, Schaffer thinks that it exceeded what's allowed under the initiative process by state law, but they don't adequately explain it to their readers, you know, which kind of I find kind of infuriating. Now, meanwhile, this week, Bruce Harrell, who kept saying during his primary campaign that he could work with Charter Amendment 29, said this week that he would actually implement it if elected mayor, which I think is a really strange perversion of the democratic process, right? An initiative doesn't make the ballot for legal reasons, and even though no one's actually voted for or against it yet, you're going to just automatically implement it.
Yeah. Well, he's going to run into the same kind of problems that the initiative did, right?
Right.
As policy.
Well, yeah. The main one being that the city's moving its homelessness services to the regional authority. Exactly. He can make all the promises he wants about how much of the city budget goes for homelessness services, but he can't implement that. For one thing, he doesn't approve the budget. The city council approves the budget. For another, that money's gonna, you know, any money that the city spends on homelessness services is gonna go directly to the regional authority, and the mayor has no control over what they decide to spend it on. Okay. But this week, Harrell struck a tough on poor people pose at a campaign rally he held in Lower Woodland Park, just a few yards from a tent encampment. Now, Harrell has refused to respond to questions about how he would remove all homeless people from Seattle parks. I mean, that's a key part of the Charter Amendment 29. Now,
although he does support the sweeps policy.
Oh, yeah, he has said that he's okay with the sweeps policy, but he won't go on the record in saying that, yes, we're just going to start moving people around the city to harass them, which is, you know, what sweeps do. Now, when asked where the money would come from to build more shelters and provide mental health services and addiction treatment and other wraparound services, Harrell mentioned some COVID relief funds from the federal government that the city expects to get next year. But that money.
What?
Yeah, I know. That money is meant to be used for COVID-19 and public health services, right? And to help businesses and individuals impacted by the pandemic. It's not meant to provide wraparound services for new homeless shelters or build new homeless shelters. There's undoubtedly going to be a need for those COVID pandemic funds to be spent on other things next year. And of course, true to form, Harrell mentioned that he would happily beg corporations to give charitable donations to fund shelter beds and services. So essentially saying that when he's mayor, he will, you know, go hat in hand and get on his knees and beg corporations to give him some pocket change, right?
Maybe he can sell the naming rights to the shelter.
Yeah. Now, Gonzalez's campaign manager, Alex Corin, responded that that's just not a plan. And, you know, he's absolutely right about that. Currently, Lorena Gonzalez is serving as president of the city council, and the city of Seattle is already spending about 12% of its budget on homelessness services and affordable housing. That's the level that Charter Amendment 29 would require the city to spend. But that's not counting a windfall from the sale of the Mercer Mega Block, which is adding tens of millions more to build affordable housing. But again, that's a one-time windfall. So Gonzalez has proposed that the city put in place a tax on corporations, particularly the largest corporations and the wealthiest residents of Seattle, in order to fund homeless shelters and affordable housing on an ongoing basis. Now, of course, complicating all this is the Regional Homelessness Authority, which is going to have final say over how the city's money on homelessness services gets spent, right? It's going to be out of the mayor's hands, and any promises Harrell makes in that regard are meaningless, literally. And he just won't be able to deliver on them, even if he wants to. And, you know, looking at Bruce Harrell and listening to some of the responses he's given to people's questions at various candidate forums, I kind of wonder if he even understands that, you know, or if he even really knows that. I have some serious reservations about his cognitive skills at this point. You know, I think he might be having some issues with his memory.
Well, it's interesting this week that I believe Amazon news broke that they're going to be anticipate bringing an additional 12,500 jobs to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. High paying managerial jobs. So it's going to put a lot of pressure on the housing market.
Yes, yeah. It is. And, you know, it's not that there isn't necessarily enough housing being built in Seattle, you know. We can drive around the city. You can walk or drive around or bike around the city right now and see a lot of construction going on. But those are all high rent apartments or condos, and they are geared specifically for people who work for places like Amazon. So those folks are not going to have a hard time finding a place to live. It's the folks who serve them in restaurants, who clean their homes, who you know, staff their grocery stores, et cetera.
Yeah, those provide folks, daycare. Yeah.
Yeah, all of that stuff. Those are the folks who can't afford $3,000 a month rent on a downtown apartment, okay? Those are the folks who are having trouble and who end up living in a tent on the sidewalk.
While they're employed.
Yeah, a lot of them are working. Now, also this week, the Recall Sawant campaign obviously missed the deadline to get their initiative on the ballot for November. So they will probably be shooting for a February ballot instead. They're still collecting signatures, and they don't have enough yet to feel comfortable that they will have enough signatures to get it on the ballot. So that's kind of interesting. They can only collect signatures from voters in District 3. And yes, the COVID pandemic makes it harder to collect signatures. However, Compassion Seattle managed to collect enough signatures to potentially get on the ballot. But the Recall Sawant campaign is struggling.
I spend a fair amount of time in District 3. I have yet to see a signature gatherer. Now, maybe I'm just going to the wrong places. Like, you know, I'm not hanging out in an upscale market in Montlake or Madison Valley, but I just haven't
seen
it.
But if they're not on Broadway, then, you know, they're really struggling.
Yep, and I'm on Broadway a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's also unclear, though, exactly how many signatures the recall campaign has actually gathered, too. I mean, mm-hmm. they could just be dragging their feet planning on missing the November election.
Oh, they have, for sure, but they have confirmed with reporters that they are still trying to get enough signatures, and they don't feel that they have gotten enough signatures. Now, they say partly it's because people are confused because some pro Sawant, or the Sawant Solidarity Campaign, was out there also gathering signatures on that initiative to try to move it ahead and get it on the November ballot. And the Recall Sawant folks are refusing to accept signatures from the Shama Solidarity Campaign. So they're claiming that that's obstruction and is making it harder for them to gather signatures.
But again,
but I don't know. I mean, if it were me, I'd just smile and take those signatures and say thank you.
Sure.
But they are they're not counting those signatures as legitimate, and so they're trying to get enough to in addition to those signatures, get them on the ballot. Now, the idea when you're signature gathering is you want to gather at least 25% more signatures than you need in case some are invalidated. Now,
and I would think that for a district race, that percentage would actually be a little higher, because some people don't even know what district they live in.
Yeah, exactly. Or they think they're a registered voter and they're really not anymore for one reason or another. Now, we saw with Compassion Seattle that they gathered about 60,000 signatures, and they needed about 30,000, and they just barely made the 30,000, because half of the signatures were invalidated, because people who signed the initiative didn't even have a home address in the city of Seattle. So that's a risk. If you're getting signatures from people outside District 3, along with, say, maybe they're walking down the street or going into the market in Montlake, you know, with a friend who lives in the district, but they don't, and both people sign the initiative, well, that's a problem. So we'll see. They're obviously shooting for a winter vote, probably February.
All right. Well, keep following that. Moving on to this week's public safety news.
Yeah, the state Supreme Court this week upheld the firing of Seattle Police Department officer Adley Shepard, and they ruled unanimously that the former Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole was justified in firing Adley Shepard. In June 2014, Shepard punched a handcuffed woman in the back of his police cruiser. Shepard went to his union, the Seattle Police Officers Guild, who then appealed his firing to a handpicked arbitrator. The arbitrator overturned his firing and ordered the city to reemploy him and give him back pay. Then the city subsequently appealed, and both the King County Superior Court and the Appeals Court ruled in the city's favor that Shepard's firing was justified. This week's ruling by the state Supreme Court puts an end to a 7-year legal odyssey challenging the arbitration clause in the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract with the city. Now, it should mean that the union is on pretty shaky footing when they argue to include arbitration in the new contract that the city is going to be negotiating with them in the coming year. But we'll see. Okay.
Yeah, and that whole arbitration process of, you know, being able to shop for an arbitrator, which is in the current union contract, a lot of activists have been saying that is one of the reform processes that needs to change.
And that's that Judge James Robart pointed up too. He particularly talked about Adley Shepard's case as a case in point for why the arbitration clause needed to be removed from the new SPOG contract. Now, also this week, the King County Office of Law Enforcement Oversight, which oversees the King County Sheriff's Department, released a report which was an evaluation of the shooting of Anthony Chilcott by plainclothes King County Sheriff's detectives in 2019. Chilcott had stolen an SUV, and there was a countywide search for him and the stolen vehicle. Plainclothes detectives were told that if they found them, they were not to engage with him, but to keep watch, to keep an eye on him, keep their distance, and to call for backup. Instead, two plainclothes detectives, George Alvarez and Josh Larum, rammed their vehicle into the stolen SUV and then attempted to extract Chilcott from the vehicle after smashing the windows with a sledgehammer, that was Alvarez, and with the butt of his gun, that was Larum. Alvarez then proceeded to draw his gun and beat Chilcott in the head with it. When Chilcott tried to grab the gun, Alvarez shot him point blank in the head, and Laram followed suit. Chilcott was unarmed. Okay, he didn't have a weapon on him at the time, and neither detective identified himself as law enforcement. That's the key issue there, is that they were driving an unmarked vehicle with out-of-state plates, and neither detective was in uniform or identified themselves as law enforcement. And there were at least 10 witnesses who testified to that. Now, the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight, in their report, describes this incident as very similar to a prior shooting of an unarmed suspect in 2017 by King County plainclothes detectives. That was 17-year-old Mechance Dunlap Gittins. Okay. Olio had issued a report on that shooting that recommended changes in how plainclothes detectives operate and changes in how they're trained, including training in de-escalation at the King County Sheriff's Department.
They totally de-escalated that situation.
All right.
From the moment they rammed their vehicle.
Right. Now, none of those recommendations that Olio made in the Dunlap Gittins case had been implemented by the King County Sheriff's Department, as the shooting of Anthony Chilcott shows. Now, Sheriff Mitzi Jo Hanek objected to most of the report, saying that she had fired Detective Alvarez. But Detective Laram remains on duty. Johannick issued him a reprimand for not wearing a bulletproof vest and identifying himself as police, but he was not otherwise disciplined. Okay. Nor did she mention any policy changes to how plainclothes detectives operate or are trained at the King County Sheriff's Department. Now, next year, the King County Executive and the King County Council will have the authority to appoint a new sheriff, and I think that they absolutely should do that. That there should be a big shakeup there in the King County Sheriff's Department. And this report really points to just some of the changes that need to be made.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else?
Nope. That's it for public safety news this week.
Okay. Well, then let's talk about local COVID-related news.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
We had our very own outdoor super spreader event. The State Health Department announced that they found, so far, 104 cases of COVID-19 related to the Northwest Washington Fair in Monroe, which happened last month. And they expect more cases to surface in the coming week or so. Because of that and other events, King County has announced that masks will be required at all indoor and outdoor events with more than 500 people, regardless of the vaccination status of the attendees, starting this coming Tuesday. And I have to say, it's about time. Now,
it's actually a little late. I mean, I live within sight of the Seahawks stadium, and those have been full crowds for the preseason. Of course, the regular season starts, I think, next weekend. And, UW has their first football game this afternoon. So those are large crowds of, I'm going to guess, given the demographics of the appeal of football, more than usual number of unvaccinated people. And
a lot of them from outside King County. A lot of people drive into King County in order to see sports games. So those can potentially be large super spreader events.
Serious super spreader events. And then next month we have the start of hockey season, which means crowds in an indoor setting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the King County Health Department is recommending masks. People wear masks at smaller outdoor events where people can't maintain at least 6 feet of distance from others outside their household. And in the meantime, I keep walking by restaurants with outdoor seating where the tables are closer than 6 feet apart and people are not wearing masks.
And I would say, given the increased transmissibility of the Delta variant, that should be more like 10 feet.
Yeah, it should be much more than that. And I think that there needs to be something done about crowded restaurants and bars, because I'm seeing a lot of those, particularly in the run-up to the Labor Day weekend. Now, about 320,000 people over the age of 12 remain unvaccinated in King County. And if you add in kids under 12, the total is 750,000, or 3/4 million people. That's 33%, or almost 1/3 of the entire population of King County still is not vaccinated. So given that kids under the age of 12, and that's about 500,000 people, can't get a shot, I think we're going to be wearing masks for a long time, and we should be.
Yeah.
And King County Health Department should say that.
And we're already at near record numbers, both for the state new case numbers and for King County. And, we had our first day of in-person classes in 17 months in Seattle schools this past Wednesday. So it's going to be very interesting, particularly for Seattle Children's, to see what the hospitalizations look like in about 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah. Now, Thurston County, Pierce County, and especially South King County remain hotspots for COVID-19 infections. And as Jav said, hospitals have filled up with patients. The Biden administration has not been reimbursing hospitals recently for the treatment of COVID-19 patients, and hospitals are beginning to pass those higher costs on to patients. So people who haven't been vaccinated, you're really taking a huge financial risk right now, because you're not necessarily going to get free treatment if you end up in the hospital. Likewise, we don't know how much longer the federal government is going to pay for COVID-19 vaccinations for people who haven't gotten them yet. Right now, the shot is free, okay? But they're not always going to be. And that's something that I can pretty much guarantee you, that if you don't get vaccinated when the vaccines are free, you're crazy. Okay, because they're not always going to be free. So that's another argument for people who are holding out. But the good news is, of course, nationally, vaccinations are going up.
Yeah.
So some people are being persuaded.
Particularly in the South for some reason.
Yeah. So some people are being persuaded that it's actually a good idea to get vaccinated. So don't give up on your friends who are holding out.
That said, the South is also starting football season actually today. And those are going to be super spreader events because of the percentage of the population that's unvaccinated. Of course, colleges took a huge financial hit with the loss of a lot of games last year, 2020. And so they're very anxious to pack those stadiums. And that's what they're doing. And in a lot of states, they don't come with any kind of mask or vaccination restrictions. So I think we're going to see super spreader events there too.
Yeah, and it has the potential to really disrupt the college football season too, because, you know, the virus doesn't just stay in the stands.
That's very true. Mm-hmm. And so we saw an epidemic sweeping the country this week. The epidemic of stupid. A lot of people taking horse dewormer because they have somehow been convinced that that it prevents COVID, which it does not. We've got at least one report of hospitals in rural Oklahoma being overwhelmed, not just with COVID patients, but with patients overdosing on ivermectin.
Yeah, you are not a horse. Take a horse drug.
You're not a horse. We've also seen some of the messengers touting the benefits of ivermectin, specifically Joe Rogan, who's a right-wing sort of social media guru, turned up positive for COVID-19 this week. So hopefully that's a cautionary tale, but I wouldn't count on it. People will probably just dismiss that as a conspiracy. They wanted to infect Rogan to make ivermectin look bad, or some idiocy,
some stupid thing like that. Yeah.
We're also seeing a number of high-profile breakthrough cases. Specifically, the Boston Red Sox have lost about a third of their roster in the middle of pennant season for baseball. That's gotten a lot of attention this week, and the numbers just keep creeping up. We've got a record number of infections, a record number of deaths going back to last winter. It's not trending in a good direction. And as the weather cools in much of the country and as people start to move indoors, it's just going to get worse, unfortunately. And yeah. The school starting. We're seeing a number of school infections around the country where school started in August. And, you know, they're having to quarantine a large number of their students in September. Particularly Mississippi has been hit hard by that. Louisiana with Ida, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Which Louisiana and Mississippi have the lowest vaccination rates in the nation.
Yeah, and the highest per capita infection rates in the nation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for people who think that the vaccines don't work, you know, the numbers are proving you wrong. The vaccines do work.
And we've had those numbers for 9 months now.
Yeah. So. Now, 1 out of 8 Americans has tested positive for COVID-19 so far, and 1 out of 510 Americans has died from it. That's a total of 643,000 people so far. Currently, about 1,500 people per day are dying from COVID-19. 1,500 people. Now, new cases are totaling over 2,000 per day just in this past week. It just bumped up over 200,000 per day, as high as January's peak. So we are definitely in full swing for another peak that could creep even higher than what we saw over the winter. The total number of Americans who have tested positive for COVID-19 now is 39.5 million. That's about 12% of the total population of the United States so far.
And just to be clear, I mean, we're seeing anti-mask protests in different places, particularly in Europe, but we are not seeing these huge number of infections anywhere else in the world. This is strictly an American problem, and it's a problem of stupid, honestly. And ignorance and fear and owning the libs. It's really a function of our politics.
Yeah. Now, the Biden administration is pushing ahead with booster shots, initially for healthcare workers and elderly people, with the target start date of September 20th. And this week, Moderna announced that it's probably not going to be ready by that date. So the initial booster shots will be of the Pfizer vaccine only. And because the FDA has not studied the impact of mixing vaccines, taking a shot of Pfizer here and a shot of Moderna there, they are not recommending that people who got the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccine line up to get a booster shot of the Pfizer.
Yep. I got Moderna originally, and I got a Moderna booster shot last week, but I'm immunocompromised, and those are the only – we are the only people – we're the chosen people who can actually get booster shots now. That's been approved.
Just yet.
Yeah, and there's plenty of anecdotal reports of other people because, you know, all you have to do is walk into a drugstore or a grocery store and attest that you're immunocompromised, who are getting the booster shots prematurely. That's not a good idea because we don't have the science in on it yet, particularly for mixing shots. So hold off until and we're seeing some scientific pushback on that timeline also. So it may not be that quickly.
The recommendation is what, Jeff? 6 to 8 months after your first vaccination, or is it the second vaccination?
After the second vaccination.
After the second. Yeah. So no sooner than 6 months. But I think ideally with the Pfizer shot, they're saying around 8 months, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So, health experts said that they are very concerned about a surge that they expect to be brought on by the Labor Day weekend festivities, combined with kids going back to school this week, that may cause a surge of cases in the next 2 weeks. So that's something that we should be on the lookout for. Last year, before we were dealing with the highly transmissible Delta variant, the U.S. saw a 400% surge in COVID cases between Labor Day and Thanksgiving. And kids were not in school. Most kids were not in school at that time. So I think a 400% increase in cases is probably a conservative estimate of what may happen.
Although a year ago last month was when the federal government officially adopted a policy of trying to encourage herd immunity, which in retrospect looks genocidal.
Yeah.
But just saying.
All right. Anything else on that?
Let's move on. We got more bad news to get to.
That's right. Okay, let's talk about the Supreme Court in Texas.
Oh, Maria, do you want to take this one? I have a headache.
Sure, I will start us off on it. By a 5-4 vote, the conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block a Texas law that bans abortion as early as 6 weeks before many women even know they're pregnant. And that law also allows private citizens to sue anyone who helps a woman get an abortion, basically setting up a paid vigilante system to rat out and punish women who attempt to exercise their right to determine when and if they should have children. Now, in an
I would say it's actually more ominous than that, because the Supreme Court let stand a law that is clearly unconstitutional on the basis of Roe, which is 50 years of settled precedent. What other constitutional rights is the court okay with allowing a vigilante system of private citizens to rat out people for? The obvious place that I think a lot of red state governments would look to next, after they're busy passing laws mimicking the Texas law, is voting rights. You know, why not make it illegal for blacks to vote? That's a constitutionally protected right. Et cetera, et cetera. You can definitely see a slippery slope here, where the court, by the conservative majority of the court, thank you, Donald Trump, by refusing to, hold the line on this, it sets a really, really dangerous precedent.
Yeah. So in an unsigned opinion, Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett refused to stop the law from taking effect while it winds its way through the courts. Opposing this stance were Justices Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, who was particularly blistering in her written opinion.
Yes, Elena, she was.
Elena Kagan, and Chief Justice John Roberts, who is usually considered a conservative, but not on this opinion.
Yeah.
Justice Sotomayor called the Texas law flagrantly unconstitutional and said that the conservative majority on the court were burying their heads in the sand. I think that's maybe a charitable view of the conservative majority on the court. In the meantime, Nancy Pelosi has vowed to pass a bill in the U.S. House of Representatives to ban state laws that would limit abortion procedures that are guaranteed under federal law, under the Roe v. Wade decision. But there isn't a majority in the Senate that can overcome a filibuster. And this week, women's rights groups put pressure on conservative Democrats in the Senate to get rid of the filibuster rule. So far, the conservative Democrats, like Kristen Sinema, for example, are not heeding that or paying attention to that pressure.
And there's been a major national women's march called for October the 3rd. So that will put some additional pressure, hopefully, on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Now, meanwhile, the Texas law, which was specifically designed to make it difficult to overturn in a lower court, went into effect this week in Texas, forcing women's healthcare providers to stop performing literally all abortions, including pre-viability abortions, which are obviously legal under federal law. Only once a woman has been turned away and then sues the state of Texas will the law be fully challenged in court, and that's going to take some time. Texas clinics are reporting that they're having to turn away women who are in tears, that many women are making plans to travel outside the state to end their unwanted pregnancies. But
I would add to that there are national networks that have sprung up to provide financial assistance for that.
Because there are many women who simply can't afford that. The cost of travel and a hotel room, taking time off work, and the worry of catching COVID-19 may prevent many women from following through on that.
And daycare, because a lot of them have kids already.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the biggest reasons for a woman to want an abortion, is because they simply can't afford to and can't support an additional child in a family where they already have perhaps too many children. Only about a dozen states have laws on the books that explicitly protect a woman's right to an abortion. Washington state is one of those states, and so is Oregon and California. Now, at least 8 states have trigger laws that would ban abortions automatically if and when the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, as they
actually
expect to do later, perhaps later this year.
Yeah, I heard 11 states. And there is a Mississippi case that the court is hearing.
There's
that it will,
eight
that it
states. Will. There are some others that have similar laws, but they're not automatic trigger laws. Now, Idaho is one of those states that has a trigger law. So, Idaho. Now, at least seven states with Republican governors are considering laws similar to the Texas law. These states include Arkansas, Florida, Kentucky, Louisiana, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and South Dakota. And other Republican-led states are expected to follow.
Yeah, that was yesterday's list, so it's probably longer now.
Yeah, but those are the seven states that are actively writing laws right now.
Yep.
So
that we know of.
That we know of. Yeah, so I think it's just a matter of time before the conservative majority on the Supreme Court. They're expected to hear challenges to Roe v. Wade in the coming months. And I think we now see the writing on the wall. So women who have been kind of sitting on the sidelines thinking, oh, the Supreme Court will never overturn Roe v. Wade. It's time to get out into the streets if you haven't been in the streets already.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be nice if men could join them.
It would be nice, yes.
Yes.
You know. We need male allies as well to speak up.
Since you can't really have an unplanned pregnancy without a guy, generally speaking.
Yeah, it takes two. Yeah.
All right. Okay, moving on. Hurricane Ida.
Oi. Ida struck South Louisiana last Sunday, and then the remnants of Ida dumped a torrential amount of rain in a short period of time on portions of New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania late in the week, causing a lot of flooding and a substantial number of deaths. I think 47 was the last number that I saw.
Oh, I think it's closer to 50 now, but they're expecting to find more people, particularly in urban areas like New York City, which it's illegal to have a basement apartment in New York City, and yet the city authorities turn a blind eye to some. The estimates I've seen is around 10,000 New Yorkers who live in basement apartments, just because rents are so high. A lot of buildings rent out their basements to people who can't afford high rents in New York City, and there have already been stories of people who were flooded in their apartments and died in New York City, and they're expecting to find more.
Yeah, and the subway system flooded as well.
In a city where it's all pavement, you know.
And it's at sea level.
And it's at sea level. There's just no place for the rain to go except into the subways and into the basements. And that's a hazardous situation.
Yeah, and we saw that sort of thing during Sandy, but obviously there hasn't been any reforms since then.
Yeah. Now, for New Orleans, their entire power grid was destroyed, and it could be up to 2 weeks before power is restored to most of the city. In the meantime, thousands of residents are being evacuated now, particularly elderly residents, because they can't handle the heat without air conditioning. Temperatures have been in the upper 80s and low 90s, which is extremely stressful for elderly people.
It's also extremely humid.
Extremely humid in New Orleans, around 80% to 90% most days.
Yeah, and how do you keep food? You know,
exactly.
When it's that condition.
You can't. That's why one of the things that there's been a shortage of, along
poor
with
clean,
you know,
water.
The things that you would expect, like, you know, water and fuel and electricity and obviously food, has been ice. That is one of the essential things that people need to be able to survive that kind of heat without electricity.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ida also spawned several very strong tornadoes in at least six states, from Mississippi at the southern end all the way up to Massachusetts in the northeast. And this was not a once in 100 year storm like we're used to hearing weather forecasters say. They're now saying it was a once in 200 to 500 years storm. But of course, we're starting to hear that more often now, too.
I would say it's about a every other year storm.
Yeah.
One of the things we saw with climate change, with a number of storms recently, particularly Laura last year, what is the rapid intensification as it moves through the Gulf. Because the waters are warmer than they have historically been. That's more fuel for the hurricane. That's more moisture. So you get more flooding and more energy for the winds. So this is something we're going to see more and more of in the future.
With Laura last year and Hurricane Ida this year, it's the first time that we've seen two 150-mile-per-hour hurricanes making landfall in the United States in consecutive years. Okay, but that may not be the last time we see this.
Yeah. Shall we go for three in a row next year? Of course, hurricane season is not over this year either.
No, and in fact, September is usually the month when you see more storms than any other month during hurricane season, which is only half over so far this year.
Although August tends to be the year when you get the most powerful storms because the water is warmer and the days are longer, so there's more energy to fuel the hurricane. But yeah, you're right, and there are a number of potential tropical depressions that the forecasters are looking at right now. So we may not have to wait long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
meanwhile, California.
Talk about overlapping disasters, which is kind of the new buzzword for weather forecasters and for emergency planners. There are also the wildfires in California and Nevada.
Yeah, we saw the Calder Fire both cross the state line into Nevada and hop a granite ridge, which firefighters didn't think it could do, but the winds were such that it whipped embers way over the ridge and it would start spot fires, and those eventually caught as well. It's now in the Tahoe Basin and threatening the city of South Lake Tahoe, which is the largest resort community on Lake Tahoe. There's a lot of vacation homes, hotels, all the rest of it in that area, and all of that's being threatened right now.
Yeah, and Lake Tahoe took a lot of people who were fleeing the fire in California, fled to Lake Tahoe, and now they're fleeing again. So again, the specter of overlapping disasters means that we may begin to see people who become climate change nomads fleeing one disaster, fleeing another disaster, fleeing a third disaster, et cetera, with no place to really settle.
And we're just talking about weather events. We're not even talking about things like desertification or food shortages, any of that, which is going to fuel a lot of mass migrations around the world.
Or pandemics, which when COVID-19 hit the United States, a lot of people migrated to try to avoid encountering COVID-19 in inner cities. So we saw some pandemic pandemic migrants. So these overlapping disasters are not necessarily going to all be climate disasters or weather disasters, but they're all going to be related in some way to the changing global climate.
And once Congress reconvenes next week, one of the first things that it's going to consider is Biden's infrastructure bill, which the larger portion of that has to do with accommodating new infrastructure to accommodate climate change, to try and address climate change, to try and get off fossil fuels, try and create the kind of infrastructure that that can be appropriate going forward in a world where we can't risk having any more greenhouse gases.
A certain number of these disasters are going to be baked in now.
Yep.
Right? Because we've had
enough.
The question
is whether they're going to get worse. And so they're going to get worse for a period of time, but we still do have the possibility of arresting that process. And that's only if the federal government is really the only institution that is at large enough scale to have that kind of an impact. So far, it hasn't been encouraging.
Yeah. And given that a certain amount of these overlapping disasters are now baked in, you know, the federal government has to think about addressing, and local governments have to think about addressing ways to harden, quote unquote, harden infrastructure. And in places like New Orleans, it may be an issue of how do we try to make sure that the power grid isn't fully destroyed with the next big intense storm that hits landfall.
And Southeast Louisiana is unique in that respect because, you know, all of the transmission lines and the power lines are above ground. The reason they're above ground is that New Orleans itself is below sea level, so you mm-hmm. can't really dig. Because you'll hit the water table immediately.
And burying them isn't necessarily wouldn't necessarily help matters either because, you know, water saturated soil can damage power lines very, very quickly.
Sure. Although, you know, we saw the 8 major transmission lines into New Orleans. They were all destroyed by Ida, including one that quite visibly the tower fell into the Mississippi River. That was a function of wind and secondarily flooding, but mostly the wind. And you can at least try and protect them from that in, like, for instance, the Eastern Seaboard, but it's very difficult to do in places like Florida or New Orleans where the water table is right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then it becomes a question of human creativity. You know, what can you do? One of the things that was pointed up about New Orleans is they could have benefited if more houses had been fitted with solar panels, if there had been a way to sort of, make the power grid less reliant on bringing power into the city from big plants, but to sort of decentralize power delivery.
Yes, although the solar panels do have to survive 140 mile an hour winds.
They do. However, they're not tall towers, so
that's true.
They may be more durable in some respects.
And once the storm leaves, you get sunny, hot days.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. So there are those issues, and it takes money to do things like harden the power grid, and also takes money to provide solar panels to kind of diversify how power is delivered to inner cities. That all takes a lot of money, and that's something that the federal infrastructure bill is meant to address.
Yeah, and
or at least begin addressing.
At the same time, these overlapping climate catastrophes are incredibly expensive to address.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're going to save money in the long run because you're not hopefully dealing with as many climate catastrophes. But for the short term,
there may be parts of the United States that we simply can't have a ton of people living in.
Well, we can start with Florida in that case,
yeah.
Because, you know, we're already seeing parts of Florida that are being lost to rising sea levels during these storm surges where the water simply doesn't recede afterwards. And South Louisiana is vulnerable to that as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of people who have to move and a lot of high-end waterfront condos that keep getting rebuilt and you know, insurance companies cover when they're destroyed by a storm, they get rebuilt, they get destroyed again, et cetera. That cycle has to stop.
Yeah.
Well, at some point, the insurance companies, if they aren't already, are going to be bailing on this whole thing. So they're not going to be participating anymore.
In the past, the federal government has covered losses for insurance companies in certain areas of the United States. And the federal government's going to have to stop doing that, too.
Yeah. And
the Army Corps of Engineers is going to have to reevaluate certain parts of the United States and say, you know, these are places that people shouldn't be living anymore.
Yeah. And as, you know, a former resident of Galveston, which is on a barrier island, now most of the populated part of Galveston is protected by a seawall. But in recent years, development has extended way beyond the seawall. And those places get destroyed by a storm, and then they just get rebuilt. And you've got over in the Bolivar Peninsula, which is across the bay, you've got a state highway that has been underwater for years now. And it's still going to become part of the Gulf because that water is not receding.
Yeah. So at some point, the federal government needs to tell people, okay, you build here at your own risk. You know, you're essentially your home. If you build it in this part of the country, in this area of land, is going to be uninsurable, and you just take your own risk.
And I think that is going to stop the development before anything else does. Money speaks to people.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
A few minutes left. Ahmed Aubrey.
Yeah, we had a couple of major developments this week in terms of last year's killings of unarmed black people. The Ahmed Aubrey case in Brunswick, Georgia, the prosecutor in that case was indicted for interfering with a law enforcement investigation and violating her oath of duty. Jackie Johnson most visibly did not arrest the pair of people who took it upon themselves to kill Aubrey, who was shot while he was jogging, because people didn't apparently like the fact that he was jogging through their neighborhood. One of the two people involved, along with his son, was a former police officer, and that officer was cozy with the prosecutor, and that's why not only were they not arrested the day of the shooting, they were not arrested for several months later, till several months later, after the George Floyd killings, turned the Aubrey case also into a national story. At that point, they were arrested. They're now awaiting trial. But that delay and that interference with the investigation by the Georgia State Bureau of Investigation is why Jackie Johnson was indicted this week. It's the first time I can remember that a prosecutor has been indicted for failing to indict somebody regarding a shooting. That's a very encouraging sign, because it means that that more of the justice system, not just law enforcement officers, but officers of the court as well, are also being held accountable for failing to carry out their duties when they, might be sympathetic to the shooters. So that was a very encouraging sign. And
it's about time.
Yeah. And the attorney general of the state of Georgia, a guy named Chris Carr, who brought that indictment, he is a Republican, and he's a conservative Republican, but he's a law and order guy. And it's very encouraging to see that. It really marks a sea change. The other remarkable development we had this week was a grand jury returning indictments in the 2019 killing of Elijah McClain in Aurora, Colorado, which is a large suburb of Denver. McClain was walking home from the convenience store when he was literally accosted by police. He wasn't doing anything illegal. He was just walking. The police started to tase and beat him. Paramedics were then called, who then injected McClain with a powerful sedative drug that wound up killing him. Both the police officers and the paramedics were indicted this week by the Colorado grand jury with McClain's killing. Now, local activists in Denver have been pushing for accountability on that case for a couple of years. There were large demonstrations in Denver long before George Floyd's killing, and then, of course, last summer as well. But McClain's family also has been pushing for accountability on that. But again, seeing the paramedics who injected that drug, which eventually wound up killing McClain, you know, a healthy young 20-something-year-old, is really unprecedented. And again, extends accountability even beyond the justice system, the first responder system as well. And also underscores the fact that, you know, it's not just removing police with guns from responses to what they feel might be you know, mental health crisis, for example, but also making sure that paramedics and other first responders are properly trained. So we'll see what happens with that once it goes to trial, and the same with Georgia. But in both cases, very, very encouraging developments this week. And incidentally, I would say without the George Floyd protests, neither of those indictments likely would have happened. Neither of those cases would have become national cases. And it really increased the pressure nationally on local prosecutors and district attorneys and all the rest to take killings of unarmed black people seriously. And we're starting to see that more and more around the country. That's very encouraging. And the people who got out on the streets and protested last year, you can take credit for this, because it wouldn't have happened without you.